Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for May 4, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And the first segment, interview recorded earlier today with Tom Hertz, who is a professor of economics at American University and author of a study on economic mobility in the United States. We like to think of ourselves as the paragon of mobility, a beacon of social fluidity for the rest of the world to emulate. In fact, we're not. And we'll get the details on that from Tom Hertz in about 6 or 7 minutes. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Matthew Lazar, who is a historian who has written two books on the history of this network, Pacifica Network. His latest, just out from Black Apollo Press, is called Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War. The first book, Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, which really covers the beginning to the early 1970s, and the latest really bringing us forward from the 1970s into the present, ending with the Civil War and coup and restoration at the various stations in the Pacifica Network, and that will be at about 5:30. Before we get to that, just a few words on the economic headlines. First of all, the Labor Department reporting this morning that initial claims for unemployment insurance, people who've lost their jobs and sign up for unemployment insurance, were up 5,000 last week, following an increase of 13,000 the previous week. And 3 weeks out of the last four, there have been increases. The four-week moving average, which most analysts used to smooth out the week-to-week gyrations in this index, also rising now to the highest level it's been in months and months, actually. It looks like since late last year. We had a bottom in this indicator at the turn of the year, and now it's been edging slightly higher ever since, suggesting that maybe the best days of the job market are behind us, and believe me, they haven't been such great days, but things may be maturing, as economists say. This morning, the Labor Department also reporting that productivity, the output per hour of work for the average put in by the average worker, rising 3.2% at an annual rate at in the first quarter of this year, and compensation wages up at 5.7% at annual rate, meaning that the cost to employers were up by 2.5%. The difference between those two measures. Now, this expansion has seen remarkable performance in productivity. That is, workers keep pumping out more stuff, but we've seen very little of it in the form of wages. The compensation measure in this series also includes fringe benefits, which are greatly inflated by the cost of health insurance. If you look just at the direct pay the average worker is getting, it's going nowhere. It's essentially flat for the last several years, while productivity has been zooming. And all that product that is not going out in the form of pay to workers is going to profits to corporate owners and shareholders. That really characterizes the nature of this economic cycle. Tremendous, tremendous growth in profits, very stagnant growth in employment and wages, and the only wage growth we've seen at all at the upper 20% or so of the income distribution managers, junior and senior. And the further you go up the chain, the faster the growth of income. So it's been remarkably, even by the historical standards of the United States, which has been a very unequal place for a long, long time, this is really setting some records for inequality, unequal performance. And let's see, the ABC News Washington Post Weekly Consumer Comfort Measure, which measures the attitudes of consumers and reports on their the state of their personal finances, falling now for the second consecutive week. Quite a sharp drop in the last couple of weeks. It had been recovering, but it does seem like gas prices, rising gasoline prices, are taking their toll, really biting into the wallets of people in the bottom half of the income distribution. Walmart, in particular, has been suffering from this now for quite some time. They say it costs their average customer about $7 a week, higher gas prices. And for the average Walmart customer, $7 a week is a significant chunk of their income. People in the upper income brackets not feeling the pain so much, but people in the middle and lower are really hurting from gasoline prices. Whatever, we can't keep burning gasoline forever, and we can't keep living the way we do, but in the short term, it is extremely difficult for people who have to cope with getting around, and there's no other way to get around in most parts of this country without using an automobile. And finally, then on Friday morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics will report issue the monthly employment report, and I'm expecting for the month of April, I'm expecting a gain of a couple of 100,000 jobs, which is a good but not great gain, and no real change in the unemployment rate. Pretty weak wage gains, and it does look like the workforce is changing in this country as it ages. We're going to see fewer and a smaller and smaller share of the adult population working, which may mean that the Federal Reserve will have to be more aggressive in tightening in order to prevent the dreaded outbreak of wage inflation and slower rates of economic growth in the coming years, if this is true, if the population ages and people more and more drop out of the workforce. So this is an important topic to be looking at in the future, but something worth thinking about. What will the impact of the aging workforce, people in the baby boom generation like me, as we get older and inch towards retirement, what will the economic impact of that be? We will see in the coming coming weeks and coming years, rather, not coming weeks. This is a long-term development, not a short-term development. So let's take a little musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Tom Hertz. And that the first movement, the Allemande from the French Suite Number 5 by J.S. Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. And I don't know what it is, but ever since my son Ivan was born on January 1st, I've had an insatiable appetite for cerebral German piano music. If I were still going to my shrink, I'd probably explore what that's all about. But there you go. We'll hear a little bit more of these French, this French suite later in the program. And the United States loves to think of itself as unlike Europe, which is an ossified region characterized by rigid class distinctions. Not us. We are mobile. We are free. And we inherited distinctions of class and wealth just don't apply here. Well, in fact, that's not true. We have one of the least mobile societies in the first world. The amount of mobility seems to be decreasing over time. And there's a very excellent overview of these issues available from the Center for American Progress, their website, AmericanProgress.org, all one word, AmericanProgress.org, a paper called Understanding Mobility in America, written by Tom Hertz, who teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. And I caught up with him earlier today. And here's the interview, Tom Hertz.
Let's start by some international comparisons. We do like to think of ourselves as uncommonly fluid as a society. Is that really true when we compare the American performance to other countries?
No, it does not appear to be true. This is one finding that I drew from the research of a guy named Miles Korak, who has looked at the level of mobility in a number of European countries in America. And, for instance, Canada appears to be about half as immobile as the United States. Only the U.S. and the U.K. Stand as high immobility countries. France, Germany, Sweden, Canada, Finland, Norway, and Denmark all have better mobility numbers.
It would seem that, the kind of Anglo-American approach, individualistic, competitive economy, is not anywhere near as mobile as these social democracies, which is sort of exactly the opposite of what one might expect if you read the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, it does. It is a little counterintuitive. It does have something to do with the fact that inequality is higher in the U.S. and the U.K. than in many of those countries, but that's not the only explanation. in order to have immobility, you need not just inequality, but you need inequality that transfers from one generation to the next. So there's something about the U.S. and the U.K. I'd say it's probably got more to do with the returns to college education than anything else.
That's a favorite explanation of the inequality in the United States, and those returns seem to have increased in recent years. Do you have any theories about why that's the case?
That is a hot topic in labor economics. I don't have a good sense of what the current consensus is on the rising college premium. But basic economic theory suggests that the more you reduce the cost of college education, the more you subsidize college tuition or loans, the greater the supply will be of college graduates, and that should drive down the rate of return. So, and more to the point, from a mobility point of view, what really matters is access by low-income families to university education. It's the link between parents' income and educational outcomes that really drives intergenerational persistence of inequality.
All right, let's talk a bit about this. Just how mobile is the United States? You know, we believe the rags-to-riches stories. How likely is it that someone born into a poor family will turn into, if not Bill Gates, at least a prosperous lawyer?
Well, of course, that depends on how you define your categories. And one thing that's important to understand is that none of the survey data can tell you much about the prospect of getting super rich, because the Bill Gateses and even the millionaires are just not in the studies. So the prospects of being a millionaire are quite low. What I can do instead is look at, say, the top 5% and look at families that come from different places and what are their probabilities of their kids making it into the top 5%. If the world were random, then regardless of where you came from, you'd have a 5% chance of making it to the top 5%. But in fact, if you're born to the bottom fifth of households, not all of whom are poor, you only have about a 1% chance, whereas if you're born already in the top 5%, you have better than a 20% chance. So there's sort of a 20-to-1 advantage of the rich in assuring that their children will be rich when they grow up.
What's the fate, the likely fate of someone born into that bottom 20%?
Looking at the sample that I looked at, which were people who were kids in the late 60s and early 70s, of those born in the bottom 20% bracket, about 40% of them stayed in that bracket as adults. Now, that does not mean that they earned less money than their parents, because general increases have meant that the brackets have been moving up. But 40% were still in the bottom bracket. Another 20-some percent were in the second bracket. And only about 6% made it to the top 20% of the income distribution.
And then what about people born elsewhere in the distribution? Are middle, people born at the middle likely to stay there, and people born at the top likely to stay there as well?
People born at the top, it's almost symmetrical with being born at the bottom. About 40% of those born at the top stay at the top, again using quintiles. When you get to the middle, it's rather interesting. In fact, mobility at the middle is very nearly random. There's only a slight tendency to stay at the middle if you're born in the middle, and the odds of going significantly up or significantly down from there are quite good. 19% end up in the bottom quintile, 17% end up in the top quintile. So in a sense, the mobility that I'm asking for, if you take mobility to measure equality of opportunity, it is present for the middle class. It's just not present for the rich and the poor.
How does race figure into this? Is a white person born into the bottom quintile more or less likely to move up than a black person?
Well, that's an important point that has basically been ignored in much of this debate. There is not a single mobility number. There are different probabilities for different categories of people. And race is, in fact, one of the main predictors of low mobility outcomes, poor mobility outcomes. The chances for a black child who is born at the bottom quarter this time, rather than quintile, of making it to the top quarter are about 4%, whereas for whites it's about 14%. So there's a 3 or 4 fold advantage for whites in terms of upward mobility.
What do we know about the mechanism of transmission of privilege or deprivation? Why is there such a strong correlation between parents' status and that of their children?
There are a lot of factors at work, and you can break them down in various ways. You can talk about what is it about the kids of successful parents that makes the kids successful. You can say, what was it about the parents beyond their money? Is it really just the money? We know that it's not the case that increasing parental income will necessarily improve the outcomes of their children by as much as those numbers would suggest. It's more than money that differentiates successful parents and their successful children from the less successful. But if you step back and think about the different mechanisms, clearly education is important. The fact that parental income is able to buy more and better education is a huge, probably the dominant factor in all of this. I believe race is still important, not just on paper. I can show that it's important on paper, but I think it speaks to a broader issue of equality of opportunity, from outright discrimination to the internalized attitudes that may hold back African-American youth in this country, and other factors like the relation between neighborhood and schooling.
Well, can we sort out those influences? How much of it is discrimination? How much of it is bad schooling? How much of it is rough neighborhoods or an unfriendly home? Do we have any data on just how those stack up?
Well, I have done some comparisons or some regressions to try and figure out which factors are important and which factors aren't. I don't feel like I've got those to the point where I can really assign a share to each different cause. In a crude way, I estimate that race makes up maybe 10 or 20% of the mobility story, and education probably makes up about a third of it. But like I say, those are very crude estimates. In general, I should stress that these mobility numbers are they're a good way to summarize the overall prospects for advance for different people. But when it comes time to understand the mechanisms, we really need much more carefully focused studies that can diagnose individual problems. You don't want to study problems in the educational system by looking at overall mobility. You want to look at, you know, black-white test score gap and all the debates about school resources and outcomes for children. That's all the mobility numbers really do is point our attention back to these recurring social scientific debates about how best to educate our children and how best to improve opportunity for people born to lower moderate income families.
There are also some other factors you list in the paper, religion, region, and even the cleanliness of the house. So let's talk a little bit about those. First of all, let's talk about region. What do we know about how geography and mobility go together?
Well, I did find some interesting differences by region. And what I do here is I sort of say, what predicts your income, controlling for absolutely everything under the sun about your parents' background, your family background that I have, including the region of the country that you were born in. And I found that those born in the South Atlantic, from Delaware and Maryland down to Florida, that was per se the most upwardly mobile region. And the least upwardly mobile region were the mountain states of Colorado, Arizona, Utah, et cetera. What I find interesting about this is that the Sun Belt states, which one thinks of as the fastest growing over the period that I study here from the early 70s to the late 90s, are not actually the ones that score best in terms of mobility. In other words, there must be other things explaining the rapid income growth in those regions.
Yeah, I want to get back to this growth issue in a second when we talk about shorter-term mobility, but what about religion? Does it have an effect?
Religion does appear to have an effect. Just looking at all the different, in regression, the sort of controls for every aspect of parents' background that I could think of that was in this study, and there's a long list of attitudes and expectations and the degree of future orientation and all this kind of stuff. When you include religion on that list, it's a strong predictor. The highest mobility groups were Catholics and Jews, and the lowest mobility groups were Southern Baptists.
I'm speaking with Tom Hertz, who's a professor of economics at American University and author of the paper Understanding Mobility in America, published by the Center for American Progress.
And what about parental attitudes? Does it help to grow up in an optimistic, hardworking household? Does it have much of an effect?
There is a debate about which particular parental attributes matter most. And previous research has shown that some variables that measure people's sort of sense of control over their destiny or their degree of fatalism are highly correlated between parents and children and are strongly predictive of economic success in both generations. I actually, in the early days of the study that I worked on, they did ask questions about your attitudes, about your degree of destiny, your control over your destiny. And those variables didn't perform well at all for me. They didn't really seem to make much difference. I do find some interesting things that children of pessimistic parents earn less than children of optimistic parents. And one finding that others have remarked on before me is that Asking the interviewer how clean the household was turns out to be a pretty good way of measuring something which is highly correlated with economic success, so that all else equal, income, race, education, and all the other questions equal, having been raised in a clean house seems to predict that you will have certain economically successful attributes and make more money as a grown-up.
Well, I just had a kid a few months ago, so I would have to go home and clean the house now.
The issue there is that it may not actually be cleaning the house that makes a difference. It may be that it's just a sign of who you are.
Yeah, we'll have to work on that then. Hard work. Is hard work rewarded the way the moralist will tell us?
Well, I don't think anybody denies that your prospects for making money improve if you work hard than if you don't. It's also important to realize that this idea of hard work has really been built into our concept of mobility. The American dream is not just about how everybody gets rich. It's about people who work hard will get rich. I didn't find much evidence that working long hours per se makes a difference for the mobility outcomes of your children down the road. And when I looked at the short-term mobility outcomes, year-to-year mobility results, I found that sometimes working long hours does predict upward mobility, but in the most recent economic expansion, it does not seem to predict upward mobility. And I infer that in some sense that represents a deterioration of the type of mobility that the American dream celebrates.
Oh, yeah, we've been talking mostly about long-term mobility, movement over 20 or 30 years, but now let's talk a bit about what happens over the shorter time span, year to year or over a decade. How much volatility, seems to be a word you prefer to mobility, is there on that shorter term?
Well, that's what I cover in the second half of this report, like we say, looking at year-to-year outcomes for the same family. And there's a number of interesting findings there. First of all, as you point out, volatility, the overall amount by which your income is likely to go up or down from one year to the next, that amount seems to have increased pretty dramatically. I look at various time periods. I look at the 1990-91 recession. I look at the 1997-98 expansion, and the most recent year for which data are available, 2003-2004. And, you know, the average household saw a change in income of, you know, if it gained income, it might have gained $8,000 or lost $8,000 back in the 90s. In the late 90s, those numbers were closer to $10,000 or $11,000, and that's where they are today. So the average downwardly mobile household lost $11,000, and the average upwardly mobile household gained $11,000.
97-98 was, of course, about as good as the U.S. economy gets, and wages were actually rising during that period. But you had some interesting comparisons between 90-91, which is a recession period, and 2003-2004, which is an expansionary period. Was the expansion really translating into good times for American families?
No, I think these mobility numbers echo some of the findings that other people have reported about the disappointing effect of the current economic expansion on the median household income and other measures. A number that's already been well known is that even though we had 4.2% GDP growth in 03-04, that was exactly the same as 97-98. But in the earlier period, that translated to a 3.6% increase in median household income. And in the most recent period, there was no increase in median household income at all. So we have growth of the total, but no growth for the median household. I add to that picture by studying the mobility outcomes of the median household. Do they actually go up or down if you look at that particular household? And what I found was that upward mobility, on average, was no better in 2003-2004. It was not only, never mind the expansion of 97-98, it was no better than the recession of 90-91. In both cases, the median change in income was around $100.
And what about, how does mobility, or this short-term volatility, rather, differ across the income spectrum? Are poor people, middle-income people, upper-income people, who experiences the most up and down?
Well, one fact that people find surprising is that when you look at short-term mobility, you will always find the greatest upward mobility at the bottom and the greatest downward mobility at the top. And that's partly due to noise in measuring the data, but it's also partly just a reflection of the fact that if you take the lowest income people, they're most likely to have a good year next year. And if you take the highest income people, many of them will be enjoying an unusually good year, and in the next year they're likely to return to a more normal value. So that it doesn't really make sense to ask whether upward mobility is highest at the bottom or the top. But you can talk about changes and over time. And I did find some encouraging news in terms of increased upward mobility from the bottom over time. I also found an interesting increase in downward mobility for the middle class and even the upper middle class. One of the most striking statistics on that score was the percentage of households who saw their incomes fall by $20,000 or more. And I picked that as a threshold which seems large enough to cause you to have trouble paying your credit card bills or meeting your mortgage payments. And, of course, that leads to lasting financial repercussions. So that share of households who lost $20,000 from one year to the next was 13% in the recession of 1991, but it was 17% in the most recent economic expansion of 2003-04.
But that's got to be the reason why people just don't feel like it's a very good time, even though the headline statistics are telling us it is. Well, let's just conclude by looking at some of these longer-term mobility issues in a policy context. America likes to think of itself as a very mobile society. Your research and that of others shows that it's really not as mobile as we'd like to think. If we're looking for a more mobile society, what would be the best way to go about it?
Well, I think a key place to look is the financing of education. And we have two major problems in that score. The first is the tying of education budgets to local property taxes. You could scarcely devise a system better designed to perpetuate inequality than to say that it's going to be the local property tax values that determine the budget of the local elementary school. Now, many states take steps to equalize funding, and there's federal help with that as well, but I think we need to address that problem head on a little more directly than we have so far. And the second is the cost of higher education. And right now the Bush administration is cutting student loan funding rather than increasing it. And again, that's a direct way of improving opportunity, is to reduce the cost of higher education. I also think that we need to keep working on understanding the black-white test score gap and why it is that school resources don't seem to always be enough to improve school outcomes for disadvantaged children. And finally, it shouldn't be forgotten that a good bit of the reason that the children of the rich are rich is because they inherit a lot of money. So the vast majority of Americans support some form of estate tax, and I think that it's an important policy priority to resist any further attempts to weaken the estate tax.
And that's the voice of Tom Hertz, a professor of economics at American University and author of Understanding Mobility in America, a paper published by the Center for American Progress and available on their website at americanprogress.org. And I sometimes find myself, when I interview economists, morphing into a policy wonk, and it's kind of creepy to listen to myself ask those questions. But anyway, that's what happens when you try to speak somebody else's language. Let's take a break, and then we'll be back.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener-supported and non-commercial.
And this is WBAI in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. And my name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and then we'll be back to talk with Matthew Lazar. The fourth movement, the Gavotte, from Bach's French Suite No. 5, performed by Glenn Gould. And Before I get to Matthew Lazar, I just wanted to say a little something about what's going on in Latin America, specifically the nationalization of the oil and gas resources of Bolivia by the new president, Evo Morales. Extremely inspiring, I've got to say, in the political sense. It's really wonderful to see what is happening in Latin America. Tremendous mobilization against the dominant neoliberalism of the last 25 years, really taking several forms across the southern part of this hemisphere. There are extremely formidable technical challenges, though, I must say. The output, the oil output of Venezuela hasn't really recovered from the fight that Hugo Chavez had with the technical and managerial staff of the National Oil Corporation a couple of years ago. Oil production in Venezuela now is, I believe, 50 or 60% off its levels from before that internal fight. Venezuela now actually buying Russian oil to avoid defaulting on some of its supply contracts. Very, very formidable technical and financial challenges to anyone trying to nationalize energy resources. And this is a problem for any kind of radical regime. If you really want to move in and operate things on behalf of the masses, those who have the monopoly over the technical and managerial skills will often walk away and leave you presiding over a shell of at least the technical side of your economy. It's a problem that only a kind of internationalism can address. That is also one of the inspiring things about what's going on in Latin America now. Tremendous degree of solidarity developing among these radical regimes in the South America now. So that is really the only way to counter that kind of technical and financial monopoly that the bourgeoisie has. It's a real long-term challenge that anyone who wants to buck the system has to face. And now we're joined on the line by Matthew Lazar, who is a historian and author of two books in the history of this network. First, Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, came out around 2000, I believe. And now Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War, which just came out from Black Apollo Press. The first book covering the early history of Pacifica, and this one covering the history since the 1970s, and a lot about the Civil War that rocked this network, this station, a major battleground in that in the 1990s into the early part of the new millennium. Welcome to WBAI, Matthew.
Hi there.
Good to talk to you for the first time. Actually, we've been emailing over the years, but never actually spoke.
It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
And thank you for joining us. You open the book with a vignette, well, not a vignette, but scenes from the battle for KPFA. But I want to take us back a little bit to the topics of the second and third chapters, where you really talk about the historical roots of the crisis that came to a head in the 1990s. Specifically, quote, I believe it was something that Lou Hill wrote, the founder of this network, which kind of embodied the contradictions that have troubled us from the beginning. On the one hand, a network that wants to give voice to and speak to outsiders. At the same time, we also want to develop a large listening audience. How do we balance these competing claims? How has Pacifica managed to deal with it over the years?
Well, Lewis Hill embodied in a quote that I unfortunately don't have a copy of the book in front of me, so you'll have to read it if you want the listeners to know about it. But basically, Lewis Hill, already at the very beginning of Pacifica Radio, you had this kind of contradictory thing. You had at KPFA a desire to be the voice for the voiceless, as it is constantly said, to be the voice for the grassroots, to be the voice for to empower people, to empower individuals who could not get any place on the radio elsewhere to give their point of view. Lewis Hill being an important example of that, someone who felt completely marginalized as a pacifist by the World War II experience. At the same time, you had a lot of people who wanted to give those various forces a national, increasingly at Pacifica Radio, a national voice, wanted them to broadcast more effectively, wanted them not just to be a newsletter radio station, as people over Pacifica's history have described it, but to be a newspaper radio station, a radio station that is really a broader voice and that spoke to a broader audience. And Pacifica Radio has, for the last 50 years, been struggling with that problem and has not been very successful at resolving that problem, largely because of the way the rest of broadcasting is structured and has basically contained Pacifica Radio. What I mean by that is to say that, as people at Pacifica Radio have observed, if the airwaves were more open to non-commercial voices and to more access for ordinary people everywhere else, Pacifica Radio would not be full of people who have nowhere better to go than Pacifica Radio, and therefore have spent much of their careers fighting each other on what Pacifica Radio was supposed to be about.
Well, the early Pacifica, when I started listening to WBAI around, I think, 1967, it was pretty dominated by a high culture sensibility. There was certainly a political content to it, but there was also lots of poetry and radio drama and classical music. Of course, for the most part, that's a distant memory now. How did Pacifica change from that kind of high culture outpost to what it is today?
Well, you know, Pacifica... You want to talk about high culture, KPFA in the 50s, which I talk about in my first book, was, you know, the apex of sort of high culture, non-commercial radio. You know, Alan Watts, Pauline Kael, Kenneth Rexroth, those are the people who dominated the radio station back then. I think it's safe to say that with the emergence of the community radio era, when Pacifica Radio from the very get-go advertised itself as a very open organization, often, even then, you know, talking about the voice of the voiceless. Well, the voiceless showed up, and it turns out that they had voices in the 1960s. Many different groups of people who had largely been excluded from broadcasting everywhere, voices of the radical left, the gay and lesbian movement, the black nationalist movement, the Latino movement. All of these different movements came to Pacifica Radio for their share of this open network, and the combined result was a kind of a much more populist ideology, one that I think was encapsulated in the rather vague moniker community radio. Community radio, and I think that the community radio movement and the vision of the community radio movement sort of transformed the organization, and a lot of people who came in the community radio era experienced the earlier as elitist, and also a lot of those people moved on or they died.
So are you saying then that Pacifica was really in part transformed from influences coming from outside Pacifica, that things have been evolving in different directions outside the Pacifica walls?
Things were evolving outside of the Pacifica walls, it's true. But also the Pacifica network from the very beginning really saw itself, advertised itself, or, you know, proclaimed itself to be open and accessible.
But in fact it wasn't, was it always?
Well, open and accessible in the sense that anybody coming right up from the street could volunteer to do a program, not accessible governmentally. I'm not sure where you want to go with this.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the early governance of Pacifica. How was it run in the early decades?
It was, in the very beginning, Louisville envisioned it as a workers' KPFA as a workers' cooperative. Basically, anyone who did any work for the Pacifica Foundation or KPFA was part of something called the executive membership, and the executive membership set up, voted for a group of people called the Committee of Directors, and the Committee of Directors appointed management, which tended to be Lewis Hill, but it also tended to be some other people. It should be noted that in the early years of Pacifica Radio, Lewis Hill very specifically did not include the listeners in governance. He did not want the listeners to be involved in governance. It should be understood that when Lewis Hill started the idea of Pacifica Radio in 1946, he knew who his funders were going to be. There were going to be Quakers and people like that, pacifists who had been part of the conscientious objector movement. He knew who his volunteers were going to be. They were usually mostly people who he had been involved with as a conscientious objector during the Second World War. But he had no idea who the listeners were going to be, and he did not want to structure people who he didn't know or didn't know who they would be into his radio organization. And so he left the listeners out. He was also concerned about independence. What I mean by independence is that he wanted Pacifica Radio to be independent of two different forces. One is commercialization, but the other one was popular pressure. He understood that as a pacifist who had been very marginalized during the Second World War, you know, what pacifists often say, which is that everybody loves pacifists until there's a war. And then suddenly there's overwhelming opposition and denunciation of pacifism, as there was after September 11th, when I believe it was the Washington Times ran an editorial saying that pacifism was fascism, or something along those lines. Lewis Hill understood this dynamic. He also understood that if KPFA had been created in the late 1930s, and he and his friends had had control of KPFA in the 1940s and had come out against World War II and it had been a listener-elected radio station, the chances are that he had been voted out of office, right, by the overwhelming popular nature of the Second World War. So he wanted an organization that was both independent of commercial pressure and independent of popular pressure. And so he completely excluded the listeners from any kind of governance. I don't agree with Lewis Hill's position on this. I don't think that the listeners should have been excluded from all kinds of governance. But I do think that it's problematic to have listeners involved, the representatives of listeners involved in decisions about programming.
Yeah, I want to get back to this topic later on. I should say I'm speaking with Matthew Lazar, who is the author of Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War, the second of his histories of Pacifica Radio, this published by Black Apollo Press.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the 1990s. We're fast forward through a lot of time. There were the battles of the 60s and 70s that really opened up the Pacifica stations to a whole new demographic of programmers, a whole new model of broadcasting. But then, you know, we get closer to the present, and there was the push for national programming. I remember when I was first around WBAI, some Maury Marksman took me aside and said there's a cabal of God that failed types that want to turn Pacifica into an NPR clone.
I guess he means the Communist Party.
Is yeah, that exactly. That's exactly what he meant.
Is that what he means by God that failed?
Yes, exactly. That's what he meant.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the people who, a lot of the people who were involved in that were people who had once been very close to the Communist Party or, actually, I don't think any of them actually were in the Communist Party by then. Pat Scott, Jack O'Dell. Jack O'Dell, if you read Taylor Branch's very good book, Parting the Waters, you can read about how Jack O'Dell was essentially driven from Martin Luther King's inner circle by the Kennedy administration because of his close ties to the Communist Party. But it wasn't just the Communist Party. It was a lot of different people who came together in the early 1980s, actually. Basically, you know, I asked the question, how can we make this five radio station network something more than the sum of its parts? How can we make it something that speaks to a larger share of the national national culture? At least 5% of the population should be listening to Pacifica Radio, they argued. And how do we pool the network's resources so as to accomplish that? The problem is that it's one thing to take five basically blank slate frequencies and put them together, as, for example, Air America has more or less done with its network of broadcasters.
And not so successfully, if we believe some reports.
Well, you know, to some degree, it certainly has happened rather quickly compared to the Pacifica project. But the question is, how do you do that when you have five radio stations that are full of people who are already there, already have, you know, a myriad of shows, a myriad of interests, a myriad of followings? How do you restructure the organization when you have these people, all these people who are already there? And how do you somehow restructure it, centralize it? And that project was the project that was begun in the early 1980s. And to some degree, it has had some success, but it has run into a number of problems. The most important problem is that, again, you've got a network full of people who really don't have any place better to go. I mean, people argue now about the internet and podcasting and all these other things. We can talk about that. But through much of the 1990s, you've had an organization full of people who really didn't have a much better place to go than Pacifica Radio. And the restructuring that took place really turned a whole lot of people, really created a sort of a critical mass of exiles within the organization who churned and churned and churned.
Could you name some names of these people?
You mean critical mass? Well, you know, KPFA, I would suggest that one of the more active Free Pacifica people, Jeffrey Blankford, who Jeff talked to me about how he felt more and more marginalized at KPFA because of the professionalizing and centralizing reforms that took place there. A lot of people, let's see, I spoke, there's a very active person at KPFT named Tori Mercer, who I think felt the same way about the reforms that took place, the centralization reforms that took place at KPFT under the leadership of a guy named Garland Ganter, who was at that time a general manager there. A lot of people like that.
And so then this really ripened. We went out of the 80s into the 90s into a full-scale civil war, didn't it?
Well, what happened was is that you had these centralizing reforms that took place throughout the organization. What they did was they displaced a whole lot of people. These individuals, probably in the 1970s and 1960s, wouldn't have gotten very far in terms of resisting this, but now they had a new tool which they could use, which actually you and I, Doug, were on one of the very first Free Pacifica lists.
I remember that well. That was quite a time.
Yes. I remember being on that with people from all over the world, actually, including John Whiting, who was mentioned in my book, who was a former KPFA programmer who now lives in England. And Peter Frank, I think, was on it, and a whole lot of other people were on it. And what those lists did was they allowed people within the organization to unify, or at least to connect with each other on a national level and on a daily level in a way that Pacifica dissidents had never been able to in the 1960s and 70s and the 50s. And there had always been Pacifica dissidents, people who have felt disgruntled about Pacifica politics. But now you really could develop, thanks to the Internet, a kind of a critical mass of people, and you started seeing the beginnings of really serious dissident organizations. Take back KPFA at KPFA, the Pacifica Accountability Committee in Los Angeles, KPFK in Los Angeles, Save Our Station at WBAI in New York City. And these organizations all constantly spoke about the undemocratic nature of the changes that were taking place throughout Pacificana. What they were never able to very successfully do was convince people that democracy, a more democratic Pacifica, would be a more effective Pacifica. They weren't able to really convince people of that, so that they sort of existed in a stasis with they sort of camped out outside of the various Pacifica stations, metaphorically speaking, but they never really got anywhere. I remember that there was a media and democracy conference in San Francisco at which Pat Scott was given a media democracy award, and a whole lot of Free Pacifica activists came there and they protested this. And Michael Moore was there, and he wrote an article in Nation magazine about it. He said, "Is the whole world gone nuts? Is this what we really want to talk about? Pacifica, when we're talking about media democracy?" There's a lot of skepticism of the Free Pacifica movement from about 1992 through about 1999. And then Nicole Sawaya, Lynn Chadwick, fired Nicole Sawaya, the general manager of KPFA, in 1999. And the then executive director of Pacifica Radio, a former CPB operative, Lynn Chadwick, reacted to this very punitively by firing people who talked about the problem about her firing over the airwaves, by threatening people, ultimately by hiring sort of rent-a-cop guards and then hiring really serious corporate guards, and ultimately shutting down the station. And in the middle of this, an email from one of the national board members suggesting that KPFA should be sold surfaced.
Well, also suggesting that WBAI could even draw more money than KPFA. Right?
Yeah, right. $200 million in WBAI, and I think it was $70 million for KPFA. This really suddenly gave legitimacy to the Free Pacifica movement, a legitimacy to the Free Pacifica movement that it had never had before. Suddenly these people could say, "Oh, you see, I told you so. You know, we've been telling this for years. We've been saying that it's been going in this direction for years." And suddenly the Free Pacifica movement also had something that it had never had before. It had access to KPFA. It had access to KPFA's airwaves, because when KPFA went back on the air after a demonstration of 10,000 people demonstrated against Pacifica, it opened its arms. The staff, which is now quite frightened of Pacifica, opened its arms to the Free Pacifica movement. And so that you got the beginning of the real accelerated shooting part, if you will, of Pacifica Radio Civil War.
All right, I want to now fast forward to where we are right now. There's a new governance, well, not new, but we do have a different governance structure in Pacifica than we did before all these, before they changed the locks and the cops came in. And it is a supposedly a listener-run enterprise now. We've got...
Well, it's partially listener-run and it's partially staff-run. I mean,
the
governance system consists of elected representatives who come from the listeners and, to a lesser degree, the staff.
Where did this governance system come from?
It came from a long... I don't talk about that very much in the book. The book basically ends with the settlement of December 2001. And I have about three paragraphs about the democratization. Basically, it came from a long, very drawn-out process of negotiation and compromise between all the various victorious groups at WBAI and the other stations. It was worked out by the national board, and then three of the five local advisory boards, as they were then called, had to approve it. And two did, and then one, KPFK in Los Angeles, I believe, approved it just barely. And it was basically an the process of creating it was an excruciatingly long and difficult process, and it basically consisted of a governance system in which the listener subscribers elect representatives to the local station boards, who then elect representatives to the national board, and some of the seats on the local station boards are staff seats.
And you, at the beginning of this interview, expressed some skepticism about heavy listener involvement in governance. Could you expand on that?
Well, I think that the listeners should be involved in governance. I mean, I think that they should have elected representatives. What I worry about is the listener involvement in programming. I think that the listener subscribers are the corporate owners of Pacifica Radio. And as in any corporate organization, the corporate representatives of the corporate owners should stay out of programming, editorial, and basically programming, editorial, and news. I think that
so it would be sort of like a corporate board, and well, the shareholders elect the board. The board then hires the professional managers who make the actual operational decisions.
I'm worried about the same thing that I think that Lewis Hill was worried about, which is pressure on programmers basically to subscribe to whatever is the most fashionable left panacea of the moment, or popular panacea of the moment. That happens enough with the marathon system that we have now, in which basically offer whatever seems to be the most popular thing. Pacifica Radio was supposed to be a dialogue-oriented radio network. It was supposed to be a place where issues of shows of social justice and freedom came to the forefront, but also in the hands of programmers who are able to step back from the most popular position, whatever it is, and think critically not only about the power structure but about themselves. And I don't always feel comfortable that a system of broadcasting in which the listeners sit on program, listener representatives sit on program councils and things like that is the way to achieve that ultimate goal.
We're just about out of time, but I'll only ask you one speculative question to close with. Some people are saying that in this world of new media with the web and podcasting and everything, the whole Pacifica model is flirting with obsolescence. Do you think that?
No, I don't. I don't think that. I think that if you look at the most successful forms of media at this point on the internet, they're usually tied to radio or television stations. Radio's still the free medium. Pacifica is really millions of people still listen to radios in their cars and in their homes. I don't think that it's obsolescent at all. And although it's true that you have podcasting and blogs and all of these other things, the question of funding, of how non-commercial media is funded, is still a really important factor. So listener sponsorship works. It works in terms of funding these five radio organizations, and I don't think that that non-commercial media on the internet has solved the problem of how to get to that place yet.
Well, since we're about to start a marathon, I hope we've solved that problem. Thank you for joining us, Matthew
Thank
Lazar.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Matthew Lazar, a historian of Pacifica and author of the new book, Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War. And if you want to know the full history of Pacifica Radio, how we got to the crisis of the 90s and its resolution, 2000-2001, this is the place to go. Uneasy Listening, just out from Black Apollo Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back with a fundraising special next week featuring the excellent film Occupation Dreamland about made by a couple of filmmakers who embedded with the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah, and you can get a real sense of what imperialism looks like on the ground. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with the final movement, the Gigue of Bach's French Suite No. 5, played by Glenn Gould. Bye.